Hi, Blogging Heads viewers. This is Daniel Strauss of Woodruff and Strauss here today with my cohort, Betsy Woodruff, currently at the Washington Examiner, but soon to be of Slate Magazine.
Da-da-da!
And the contrarianism will get stronger after that or something.
Washington Examiner is a great place to work and full of delightful people, but I'm also really excited to go to Slate.
But the good news, when I was first leaked this information by a source close to Betsy, was we will be able to continue Woodruff and Strauss through this. So nothing is going to change here, except the background for Betsy. I will have, no longer will a deadly day for Metro front page of the Examiner be in the background.
Read it and weep, folks.
Yeah.
Soon it'll be gone.
So,
I mean,
but
like,
today, though, yes.
maybe literally weep because it's talking about death. I shouldn't
It
be
is
joking
kind of
about
a
that.
bummer.
That's probably poor phrasing on my part. Anyway, though, I hope you appreciate this beautiful Washington Examiner coverage because it will not be in the background.
So we're going to do semi-quick blogging hits today. But one of the things we're going to talk about right off the bat is the big news in the campaign world in the last 12 hours, which centers around a fan in Florida. And it's that Charlie Crist brought a fan onto stage during a debate on Wednesday night, and that was so objectionable to Rick Scott that he decided not to come up on the stage initially for a while, which elicited boos and an endless amount of mirth from Democratic flacks and, people who support, well, really just opposed Rick Scott, not so much support Charlie Crist, because that's the situation we're in Florida right now. So, I mean, Betsy, was this hilarious? Was this, I mean, do you have a smart take here?
I think it's funny. I think what's funny is that the fact that Charlie Crist took a fan on stage and then Rick Scott didn't want to go on stage is the number one story to come out of this evening. This is a very important election. Florida is one of the most populous states in America. Whoever's governor is probably or might preside over Florida legalizing medical marijuana, what that regulatory regime looks like. Obviously, Florida's essential in presidential elections. There's a ton of major policy issues that you can talk about when you're talking about Florida. These are big deal, substantive things that affect everyday people's lives. But the number one debate story was it took Rick Scott a little while to come out because Charlie Crist seemed to break debate rules. And
See,
I'm all about weird politics news. I think it's totally fine. I love this stuff. I loved when Mark Sanford had a cutout of Nancy Pelosi next to him because it's so bizarre and weird, and I like when politicians do weird stuff. But I do worry a little bit when it seems to totally overshadow the very substantive, very big deal issues for Florida.
I'm of two minds on this. I totally agree with you on one point that, like, because the headline in, I think, the Tampa Bay Times was that, the fan gate overshadows, sort of a very serious debate. So I'm with you there that I think that sort of really did overshadow something, and it was an unnecessary ding for Scott. But at the same time, it also kind of highlights, I think, an important part about the campaign world, which is that there is a lot of arguing and debating that goes on into campaigns de agreeing for a de to a debate, and a lot of like petty things like can you use a pencil, can you use a pen, if your candidate is short and he's taller, can he have like a little lift on, like all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, that's true.
And I guess this is kind of because like the dispute was reportedly like there was some discussion beforehand because Chris, the day two story about this was that Chris has been carrying around this little fan for a while.
Which is an awesome day two story.
Yeah.
So good.
Molly Ball at BuzzFeed, they both had this.
It's weird. Chris is kind of a weird guy. Neither he nor Rick Scott are well liked in Florida. Chris has
No,
been,
there was
they
a
both have
poll or a
very
story. They're like
low
the
approval
most,
ratings.
right.
Yeah.
They are like the, they could be the most disliked
Oh, yeah,
competitors in a
without a
general
doubt.
election in the country.
Both of them have near 100% name ID and also incredibly low approval ratings, which is kind of an interesting situation. So, the number one thing that I'm watching for in the Florida governor's race is how well the Libertarian does in the general. Because he's sort of capitalizing on this vestigial Ron Paul for President 2012 infrastructure, you know, getting his old campaign volunteers on board and getting a lot of, you know, libertarian activists who cut their teeth on that race. So it's going to be interesting to see if those people as a block can get, you know, more than 5% of the vote in the general. And if they can, I think that sends a pretty interesting message to members of both political parties that there's an active, invested group of people who vote in Florida who don't like either general election, either major party as they stand right now.
Would you blame them, though? I mean, you know, frankly, like, I reported out a story the other day on, you know, what are the biggest and most important Senate races left? And one of the things that kept coming up among pollsters, strategists, and Flax was that, you know, and there's a CPI, a study from the Center for Public Integrity out today that says, like, the in these races, the majority of ads have been negative. And I find that really frustrating because, yeah, I mean, most of this cycle has been characterized by don't back the other guy, back me, because I'm not nearly as bad as this guy. Mm-hmm. And I kind of think, by the way, I want to go back to Iowa later in our normal Iowa segment, but I kind of think that's what's helped Joni Ernst in particular. But I and nowhere more than Florida on this, right?
It's nuts. Yeah, it's a less than inspiring.
I don't know if there's much more to say about this. I think Rick Scott will recover. I know the polls are close, and they've sort of started to tip. So a few have started to tip in Charlie Crist's direction. We'll see how much it lasts. I mean, they're both pretty dislikable. You know, hell, in the end, this might just help people go to the booth anyway, and just, you know.
Maybe. It's interesting people are finally talking about this governor's race. It surprised me, like, how little national attention it got. So,
yeah.
For what it's worth.
But you know what? You know what's gotten a lot more attention lately, and deservedly so, has it been an ongoing situation out in San Diego with California 52. And there's actually a huge amount of backstory here, some of which we covered, including Mayor Bob Filner, who was a grade A lech. But the most immediate stuff is that Carl DeMaio, a congressional candidate, a Republican congressional candidate who is gay, has been accused by a former staffer of sexual harassment. This staffer has been accused by DeMaio in his campaign of having plagiarized a policy study that the campaign was caught red-handed doing. So there are shots going both ways. CNN a little while ago had a report out interviewing the staffer, Todd Bosnich, where Bosnich detailed a lot of the allegations he made against DeMaio, and they're pretty graphic, you know.
Right, masturbation in front of another person, grabbing for another person's genitals. This isn't sexual harassment, like, winky winky, someone said a weird thing, which is still totally off limits. This is, I mean, if Bosnick's allegations are true, this is really ugly, visceral, R-rated stuff.
Right.
This isn't the kind of sexual harassment that you could put in a PG-13 rated movie. This is you could only portray this in an R-rated movie.
And opponents of DeMaio, including Democrats, have said that there's a lot more going on here, that there's some shady business going on with, like, when the police were made aware, and DeMaio admitting that he's been interviewed by essentially the sex crimes division of the San Diego PD. I mean, I think it's a great story, actually, on top of a great story.
Just a great series of stories in American democracy.
I mean, but there's a part of me that also, I think there's, it's a little tragic at the same time that the scandal of, you know, this very rare breed of Republican, this gay Republican that the party really likes, and House Speaker Boehner went to fundraise for him, is, I mean, it involves sexual harassment, and it relates to his sexuality. I find that really sad.
Oh, definitely.
In this way. You know, it's much more fun when a unique candidate is brought down by something other than one of the defining traits that they're, you know, they're trying to level the playing field on both sides on this.
I mean, if you're a gay Republican and the allegations about Carl DeMaio are true and he loses his election because of them, it kind of sucks on two levels. It sucks because this is a gay Republican who could have been in Congress, who could have changed the way people perceive the Republican Party. But it also sucks because it's just terrible PR, fair or unfair. And I would say very unfair to suggest this reflects anything about other gay Republicans. But unfortunately, social conservatives are going to wave their fingers and say, look what happened. You guys backed this guy and now he's a sexual harasser. What's the Republican Party doing catering to the sodomites? Like, obviously that's an absurd thing to say, but that will be said, and it will be said very loudly in certain quarters of the GOP. So one thing, I think it's valuable to lay out the order of events a little bit with a little bit of detail, because I did some reporting on this. I did a story that broke this morning. And as we discussed earlier, I've got another story coming out tomorrow morning, which by the time this video is on Blogging Heads will be yesterday. But I don't think my editor's going to
want me. You gave me some of the spoilers.
It's interesting. It's interesting, yeah. So Bosnick, so how all this plays out, I'll talk about how my reporting fits in with this. The plagiarism story broke on May 12th. National Journal said, Carl DeMaio plagiarized us, and Carl DeMaio said, I take responsibility for this, this is mortifying, it's my fault, I won't throw my staff under the bus. Now, Bosnick went to CNN with his sexual harassment allegations probably a couple months later, because the CNN story didn't break until October, right?
Right. It broke.
So the CNN story didn't break for a long time. When the CNN story broke, DeMaio said, it's unfortunate that Bosnick is saying this because Bosnick is under investigation for a burglary in my campaign office, and also because Bosnick was fired for plagiarism. Now, there's no evidence that Bosnick is under investigation for a burglary. We don't have anything to support the assertion that Bosnick was involved in a burglary besides what Carl DeMaio said. So it's sort of he said, she said. And so the next big question is, was Todd Bosnick really fired for plagiarism? If he was really fired for plagiarism, then that would mean he's less credible when he charges DeMaio with sexual harassment. If he was fired for something other than plagiarism, that would hurt DeMaio's case. Now, Bosnick said what happened is, Bosnick says, and these are the dates, the National Journal story broke on May 12th. Bosnick said he stayed on staff for the week after. And then on May 18th, he went to DeMaio and confronted him about the sexual harassment, basically said something to the effect of, you have to stop masturbating in front of me or I'm leaving. Something to that effect. And the next day...
If you have to say it.
You know, who among us? Just kidding. It's amazing, right? Assuming what Bosnick says is true, I don't understand. But again, assuming what Bosnick said is true... These are alleged, these are allegations, these are not things we have proof of. So May 18th, Bosnick confronts DeMaio. Bosnick says on May 19th, the campaign manager, Tommy Knepper, calls him into his office and says, hit the road and we'll get you a new job and pay you $50,000 if you sign a non-disclosure agreement. Bosnick did not sign the non-disclosure agreement, and here we are. So one of the really big questions, and this is something that my reporting today was about, one of the really big questions is, was Bosnick really fired for plagiarism? And I got some emails that were not previously public indicating that 3 days after the National Journal plagiarism story broke, Bosnick was still on staff emails getting assignments. The assignments he was getting involved drafting policy stuff, drafting economic policy, drafting a path to prosperity document, doing the kind of things that you typically would not want a plagiarizer to do. And according to what these emails look like, he was being treated like a full employee with a lot of responsibilities, responsible for writing things, also responsible for tracking their Democratic opponent, Scott Peters. And there's zero indication that he was under any sort of suspension or that his responsibilities had changed. That doesn't mean Bosnick never got fired for plagiarism, but it does mean, but it tilts the needle in Bosnick's direction. And what I found unusual was that the DeMaio campaign didn't respond. I gave them more than 24 hours to respond, and either they could have said the emails were fake, which the emails aren't. But they could have said that. They also could have said, well, there are other emails where we censored Bosnick, but you haven't seen those emails. They also could have said that. There are reasonable things that the DiMaio campaign could have said to suggest that my analysis is incorrect. They didn't say those things. They didn't give me any comment on the record, which is not what you would expect from a campaign that has emails leaking. Another fun little detail in these emails is that so Richard Grenell, who was formerly, I think, a foreign policy advisor for Mitt Romney,
yeah,
is a Republican consultant, is also openly gay, is a consultant for DiMaio's campaign. And on one email...
Wasn't there some controversy with Grinnell on Romney's campaign?
I think Romney fired Grinnell because he was gay. I could be wrong about that, but I remember people saying Romney just let a gay staffer go after a criticism that he had a gay person on staff. So this is the Republican Party we're talking about when we talk about Carl DiMaio losing. These are people who operate in the Republican Party. That's obviously not the entire Republican Party. That is not the entire conservative movement, but it's a very powerful, very vocal, well-funded sector of the Republican Party. Anyway, that said, one thing in these emails, it lists assignments for different people. So assignments for Todd Bosnick, you know, assignments for the campaign manager. And then there's a list of assignments for Richard Grinnell. And one of the assignments is LA Times bullshit spin, which I emailed the campaign about, and I was like, can you explain the nature of that assignment? And they didn't email me back. So I don't know if that means the DiMaio campaign thinks the Los Angeles Times was bullshitting, or if they thought they needed to bullshit the Los Angeles Times. Either way, it's kind of funny. Interesting little glimpse. And then another assignment for Grinnell was, and I'm not quoting this word for word, but push LGBT responses to haters, which I don't know what that means. But, it's kind of interesting and fun. I always like finding interesting, fun things that campaigns are up to.
My understanding is that the LA Times has been very aggressive in a way that the DiMaio campaign is probably not too happy with and has not been for a while. That is what I get on this. The one thing I do have to add to all this, though, is that, like, this is a top race, a top house race, even mm-hmm. among the DCCC and congressional Democrats. They really want to keep this seat. It's a big priority, and DiMaio is running against Scott Peters. And so that's why both sides are kind of invested in this mm-hmm. one. That's been overshadowed by the Senate, and which looks to be teetering on the edge of Democratic control and moving toward the GOP. Mm-hmm. So do you think we're going to see more is going to come out? I mean, one of the things is like masturbating, being caught masturbating. It sounds like in the end, this is one of those things that you can't really prove definitely. Right. Right?
There's not a video of him masturbating in front of Bosnick. So...
Well, if there is, that'll do it. But
right.
And
that's how most sexual harassment allegations are. It's not like people are doing this in front of cameras, with obvious exceptions. I think if more stories come out, it's going to be because of campaign emails leaking. The story that I've got running tomorrow, good Lord willing, is more leaked campaign emails. Campaigns send lots of emails. And when campaigns have disgruntled former employees the way this campaign does, you can almost guarantee these emails are going to come out. Another thing to keep an eye out for would be if any other former DiMaio staffers come forward and say that they were also harassed or bullied by DiMaio. I don't know if that's going to happen. I don't have any evidence that's going to happen, but it's possible. So I don't think this story has been put to bed yet. I don't think it's blown over. I would expect it to kind of be a drip, drip, drip situation.
I mean, I think so. But it's one of those races that has been staying kind of under the radar, and definitely it's just an interesting story. I want to switch to another interesting story in a race that has long been considered kind of dead here for a little while, which is the Texas governor's race. I'm so old, I remember when Wendy Davis was the big thing in this cycle, and she's sort of been, she's at times fought with National Democrats, her campaign has. She's had some turnover there, and she's sort of vying at this point for attention in a lot of ways. And one way she's combated that is she recently released a new ad against her opponent, Attorney General Greg Abbott, who's paralyzed, which heavily focused on the fact that Abbott was paralyzed in when he was fairly young, I think his early 20s, and sued he was paralyzed because of a falling tree branch, and he sued basically people around and people connected to the tree and the tree branch. And the Davis campaign released an ad saying, you know, Abbott benefited from these lawsuits, but he doesn't help the paralyzed and sort of similar situations. And it was sort of, I mean, it was sort of like a taboo thing, a taboo subject to do. And the Davis campaign was pretty aggressive in highlighting reporting on this, even if the reporting was not entirely positive to their message. And Davis has been made to, or I mean, Davis has been asked about the ad repeatedly, and she's maintained that it is not focused on the fact that Abbott is in a wheelchair, but that you know, his record as attorney general and a lawyer, and his legal history in Texas, it feels a little bit like a Hail Mary to me at this point, Betsy. I mean, because Davis has been trailing by, you know, I think the very forgiving number is single digits, but usually the low double digits, about 10 points, I think. Mm-hmm. And hey, I mean, Greg Abbott is just a really strong candidate when you get down there. I mean, and it's deep red Texas. You know, I think what's surprising, what I'm reflective in this story is that, like, Davis was supposed to be the governor's candidate. I mean, this is the Democratic candidate for governor. And if going into the cycle, I would have said all the money that in any governor's race is probably going to be, or most of it is going to go to Davis in Texas. And a lot of attention there. Abbott turned out to be just a strong candidate. Yeah. And yeah, it hasn't happened. And, you know, I think a good marker for when you know your campaign is not going well is when your campaign manager leaves. And she had a very, very experienced, well-respected campaign manager named Karen Johansson, who won a tough race in Wisconsin for Tammy Baldwin, who's the first openly gay senator. I mean, but what do you think of the strategy?
I don't think anything good has happened for Davis because of this ad. It definitely feels, you know, from watching it and from reading other analysts and writers' perspectives on it, it definitely feels like it's kind of a gotcha. Ha ha. Greg Abbott isn't being a good paralyzed person. He isn't being a team player for paralyzed people. And it's like, it plays over very badly. And I think it's got an overwhelmingly negative response. And yeah, like you said, it feels desperate. I think the important thing to remember with Wendy Davis is that her campaign has been mostly about hype. And I say that in hopefully the least negative way possible. Like, there was no way she was going to win statewide. Greg Abbott is a formidable candidate. He has something like a $50 million war chest because there are different, I think there's no fundraising limits in Texas. You can raise as much money as you want. Just a huge amount of money. He's run statewide in Texas before. He's part of, you know, the Rick Perry world, working with Governor Perry. Nobody was going to beat Greg Abbott in this race, but Wendy Davis and Democratic backers got really excited when she filibustered HB2. I guess at that point it was SB2, Texas's very strict abortion regulations that they passed last summer. And she became a national political figure, household name. And then you have Democrats saying, oh, maybe Wendy Davis can win. Maybe she can do this. But it was literally never going to happen. She hasn't led in a single poll. There was zero indicator she was going to be able to pull this off. Most of the people that I've talked to in Texas say that Wendy Davis's candidacy is essentially a weather balloon. And the idea is, if she loses by less than 10, then it'll send a signal to national Democratic donors that Texas is becoming blue and that it's worthwhile for them to invest money there. So if she loses by 12 points or more, then it's a loss not only for her, but it's a really big win for Republicans, because Republicans can say all this purple Texas stuff is nonsense. Democrats, take your money elsewhere. Don't waste your time. And that makes it easier for the Texas Republican Party to sort of consolidate its wins. We'll see.
I mean, this is, you know, you like to ask, like, why aren't there more women governors? Democratic women governors, I guess this is, you know, this is one of the things. They're not running in states. I mean, like, Alison Schwartz did not win in Pennsylvania.
Didn't even get second in the primary.
You know?
Like, very embarrassing loss. Like, tailspin. I mean,
anyone could have, like, beaten Tom Corbett. I mean, power to Wolf, Tom Wolf, the Democratic nominee there, businessman Tom Wolf. But, you know, I think this is just another example of that. I mean, one of the things about that, about what you said that makes me think is, like, we're at the point in the midterm cycle in 2014 where committees and backers are starting to close their wallets or reallocate money.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wonder, like, what it's like if you're a candidate or a campaign manager, you get a call from, like, the NRSC, the DSCC, the DGA, the RGA, and they're like, we're cutting you off and we're not going to spend any more money here. You're on your own and you're probably going to lose.
Yeah, that's not that's not a fun telephone conversation.
No, I don't think so. And, like, you know, I mean, these are guys who recruit them and say, we're going to be with you.
They recruit them. They say, you're the best thing since sliced bread. You can win this race. You can save Texas. You're an amazing candidate. And then they're like, just kidding.
Yeah, not really. And by the way, all those negative attacks that have happened, anytime people Google your name now, all that stuff, all that opposition attack, that's still going to be there, but we won't. Bye. It sounds awful.
This is probably why more political reporters don't run for office. You know, I can't, like...
Really? You think that's the reason and not because we slightly suspect that we might be a little awkward, that we might say a few dumb things, you know, in our cups, maybe, you know, after a drink or two?
Speak for yourself.
Because when do we go out and drink and say dumb things?
I don't know where you're getting that. I don't know why you
would
think that.
I don't know
why you would think that.
I did once do a 20-second vet of myself.
Oh, yeah? How do you do that?
I just was like, what if I ran for office? And then I looked in my inbox and my recent Gmail conversations. I was like, nope, can't do it. Nope. And that was just, you know, didn't even go through my Facebook, academic record, all that. Nope. You've never done that? You've never, like...
Oh, I mean, I've, like, sort of thought about it. And then there was a point in college, I think, where I would specifically, like, send stupid emails to be like, guess what, future Betsy, never running for office. Ha, 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 dumb email. Sort of
and you haven't even got over your friends, your enemies, you know, all that
papers
stuff.
Papers I wrote. Nothing good.
Nothing good. I think you have to be a remarkable person. And even then, I don't know.
There's an Onion article that says Republican and Democratic parties vetting candidates for, like, the 2036 race. Like, Republicans are really excited to find a guy who lives in a trailer park and has
Chelsea's
never had
daughter.
Access to electricity
Chelsea's
and the
daughter.
Internet.
Yeah.
And has never had access to the internet, has never put anything on social media. He'll be a great candidate.
He'll be a winner.
And they're like, we found that we thought we had this great guy. He's 18 years old. He's, you know, clean guy, member of, you know, politically active, great grades. And then we went through his Facebook page for 2 seconds and found a picture of him hitting a lacrosse stick bong. So he can't be president. It's really funny.
One of the things.
Think about how many people you know like that, where it's like, oh yeah, this person could definitely run for office unless you, like, have 2 beers with them.
I have 2 people, one person you know who I think would be good to and probably will run someday.
Interesting. You have to tell me that.
He is.
What does his name rhyme with? What does his name rhyme with?
I'm not gonna give you but just think about it. You know, he's a friend of mine. But like the majority.
Is he a good friend of mine?
Or
is he more like a pal acquaintance?
He's an acquaintance.
Okay.
You know. Anyway, and he'd be good, but I think the majority of people we know are friends, and people we like wouldn't be very good.
Definitely not.
I did want to move to, well, before we move to Iowa, I did want to talk about Colorado for a second, where Cory Gardner is in the lead against Mark Udall, which is remarkable, because I thought that Cory Gardner's support of personhood amendments, which Democrats... That's their knee-jerk word. If you, like, do word association, Cory Gardner, personhood, all of it, straight, crazy. You know, he's leading Mark Udall now. And he's been
leading for a while.
Yeah, and Deadspin wrote a story yesterday about how it looked like Gardner had lied about his history as a football player. And when I read the story, walking home in the rain, because that's what I do, I'm a sad bastard, I was like, wow, Corey Gardner got Manti Te'o'd. And they had like a quote from like a former coach who like was the expert of the small town Gardner grew up in, was like, he wasn't on the football team. Turns out that story was wrong. And the Gardner campaign tweeted out pictures to everyone. Gardner's campaign manager tweeted out a picture to me. I didn't write our write-up of that story or the original story. Deadspin has had to walk this back. And they were just, they're basically like, we screwed up here.
And this is, and it's a really, it actually is kind of a who among us situation, because I can imagine doing that. You know, you think you've got a great source. Oh yeah. You know, you trust your sources. You find somebody who says they know and tell you something. And then 24 hours later, they're like, just kidding. And you know what really happened? You know what really happened? Deadspin got Manti Te'o'd.
Yeah. You all were so right. In the end, oh my God, it turns out that they were wrong. Look how proud of you.
I'm going to tweet that. I'm tweeting that.
But this is sincerely, and this is one of the things, I mean, this is the reporter's nightmare. This is what keeps us up at night. This is gets us to call our editors on Christmas Eve as they're like cutting the chicken and being like, wait, I've got a call from Daniel. And, you know, it's saying, he's just worried about this. He said he hasn't checked it yet. You know, this is why we do the crazy things.
Oh, yeah. This is why you like wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning, like not knowing what you're worried about. Because right. some lizard part of your brain is like, you probably
there's
messed
a disturbance
up.
In the force.
Horrible.
Would that have even really brought Gardner down?
Yeah, totally. If Gardner was lying about playing football, I mean, think about Mitt Romney's dog and Mitt Romney's dancing horse. Think about Rick Scott's little thing. I think about Bruce Braley suing over chickens. These kind of stupid little stories can have a big impact. And if it turned out Gardner made up being a high school football star, everybody would have made fun of him, and the entire final 3 weeks on the campaign trail, the only thing he'd be able to talk about is like, oh, hey, sorry I lied about playing football.
Just
sorry I did the stupidest lie in the world.
Because I can imagine you'd all just suddenly showing up to football games and, you know, in a camera, you know, showing up for an interview in a Broncos jersey. Oh, hello. I'm just, you know, just casually here. Just throwing a football or something.
It's great for Corey Gardner. It's great for Corey Gardner. You know, because now everyone's talking about, oh, look at cute Corey Gardner. He played football when he was in middle school. I'm tweeting this thing about Manti Te'o, by the way.
Great. Fantastic. This is live tweeting Woodruff and Strauss. I am, but in all seriousness, I'm a little amazed, honestly, that Gardner rose to this level. A friend of mine was just out in Colorado, and she says that Gardner up front is a really impressive candidate. He was really young and green to me, and that was my read early on. And Udall is one of these dynastic political families. Why didn't the personhood stuff bring him down, Betsy? I mean, the switch from personhood to over-the-counter contraception.
Because I think it didn't bring him down because there's voter fatigue about women's issues. I think it's the number one thing Democrats have talked about for the last 3 years.
2 months.
And
but 3 years on the
since Romney, And I think eventually people feel like they've been hearing it and it's the only thing they've heard. Like, Democrats talk about abortion the way Republicans talked about Obamacare 6 months ago, where it was like, wow, do you guys care about anything except for this one issue? And even though it's a big turnout, it can drive turnout for Democrats. If you have a Republican who's putting forward a serious message, and who also has kind of an interesting, innovative idea with over-the-counter birth control, it's very appealing. And on top of that, a candidate who's not screwing up, who's running a disciplined campaign, who's affable and interesting, you know, running against an incumbent who doesn't have a lot to run on, then it makes sense. It doesn't really surprise me. And also, midterm election electorates are fundamentally different from general election electorates. So that's part of it. Turnout's going to be lower. It's going to be more activist bases. You're going to have probably fewer young people, maybe fewer women than you might typically have, and sort of being, you know, a one-trick pony the way Udall kind of has been, or at least has been characterized, doesn't necessarily do it. You know, the Real Clear Politics polling average of recent polls actually has Gardner up by 3 points average. That's nuts. Like, up by 3 points. Who would have expected that?
My prediction at this point, based on that, I have a rule which is incumbency and dynasty status gives you a 2-point push, so I still think Gardner is going to win. But I think it's going to be really close, but I think in the end, Gardner wins. There you go, Betsy. You have a prediction.
That's a great prediction. That's a good prediction, Gardner,
again,
by a point.
Let me caution to everyone, I am consistently wrong on predictions. I have a great record of picking the exact wrong horse every time. And I look at the data, I just have, it's my gift. It's my gift. Let's talk about Iowa next for a second. Joni Ernst. We're getting real close here, and this is one of the big races, and over and over again, I keep thinking, there's so much, like, this race is so interesting for so many reasons for me. We've talked about it before, but one of the things that strikes me is how negative it is. And I just, it's such a contrast. This was supposed to be a sleeper race. It was supposed to be Bruce Braley gliding in over a rich guy named Mark Jacobs, and that's it. And Ernst is beyond a formidable candidate. She's running ahead of Braley now, who I still think of as an incumbent senator, even though he's a congressman. That's how, you know, used to the original idea I was.
And, that's wild.
During a hearing on Ebola today, Bruce Braley was very active and very, very present there. And there was a lot of snarky tweets from people on Twitter and a lot of quotes from reporters saying Braley, who's running for Senate, is at this Ebola hearing, which I actually don't really, I don't think you can, I think you have to give the benefit of the doubt to members of Congress going to committee hearings and that stuff. But lately a lot of the attacks has been X candidate has missed this hearing or Y candidate has gone to these hearings. And like one of the GOP attacks that on Braley was that he missed a hearing on Veterans Affairs, but he was at a Benghazi hearing. If I'm correct.
Yeah.
You know.
I mean, I think we've gotten to a very cynical point in American politics if we criticize members of Congress for going to committee hearings.
Someone pointed out recently, like, have you been to hearings? Like, Joe Scarborough pointed out, like, have you been to these hearings? They were awful. They're like, you know, will Mr. Chairman take point two and ask the record state that point five on, you know, subsidies for beef in the South. Like, they do sound effing awful.
They're not the most exciting entertainment.
Or productive in some cases.
But I think it's fair game to criticize congressmen for not going to hearings, though. You know, that's their job. And if anything, I think it's a reasonable expectation. You think about how much of an advantage incumbents have in general election races. A lot of the time they don't spend going to hearings. They're going to spend going home and retail politicking, or they're going to spend fundraising, you know, going to fundraisers and calling donors. So I don't really weep salt tears about expecting congressmen to go to these things. And I think especially with a veterans scandal where that's, you know, that clearly is the collective fault of a lot of people being really bad at their jobs. You know, Braley was on the committee. He didn't go to a bunch of the hearings. It doesn't mean Braley was like single-handedly, you know, punching veterans in the face. I think it's fair game.
I'll give you this though on that. It doesn't mean he was punching veterans in the face. It's true. But it's a little bit of a stretch to say he's anti-troops. On the flip side, though, Democrats were very happy to trumpet Ernst's record in the state legislature on going to the equivalent of Veteran Affairs meetings. And she's a lieutenant colonel in the National Guard. Mm-hmm. People, I think she's okay with the military, all right? I'm just going to throw that out there.
Just a thought.
What are your thoughts 3 weeks out on this race?
To be honest, I don't have any special intel into it. I haven't written a lot about it. My gut is that it's going to be really close and Ernst gets over the finish line just because this...
Why do you think it's going to be close?
Because it's
Iowa.
You think Ernst is going to win by a comfortable margin?
I did not say that. I said the only thing I'm going to say at this point, I don't think it's going to be close.
Let's look up. I'm gonna look up the RCP average.
Our average has her at about a little bit above three. The TPM poll tracker average has her about above three.
Okay, so Real Clear Politics has her up by two. I think it's safe to say. So TPM.
We're giving Ernst more points.
The liberal TPM, even the liberal TPM. It's clearly a toss-up race. There's been a ton of polling. There has been a spread as far as polls. And I'm inclined to say just sort of the general election, you know, how emotions and feelings are going to be really good for Ernst because people are so mad at the president and there's so much fear. And it seems like there's some really, really horrible news story comes out every day. Like, oh, ISIS is headed for Baghdad. And also, an Ebola dog just got euthanized. Regardless of whether or not Bruce Braley is responsible for the euthanization of the Ebola dog, it's not great for him. So I think you're right about Ernst being able to pull this off. I will be surprised if Braley wins. Like, I can say that, but it's going to be close, like super close.
We got one more topic to go over and then I want to cover something unrelated to politics here.
Oh boy.
Kentucky, the DSCC announced that they're not going to reserve any more ad time there. That's the news. And I phrase that way because they maintain that they are not pulling out of there. They're just not going to continue to reserve additional advertising time. And now a lot of prognosticators and a lot of forecasters and a lot of armchair pundits who are like, Mitch McConnell could lose. We're sort of like, I knew this would happen. But the thing is, this came right after Grimes, in an interview with a major newspaper in the state, refused to say repeatedly whether she voted for Obama or not. And I got to say, Betsy, like, you're a Democrat. The way that Grimes said this was also really bad.
Yeah,
she said, you know,
she just kind of goes,
well, no, she right, but she also said she's a Clinton Democrat,
yeah.
Right? She said, "I'm a Democrat. I'm a Democrat of the popular one right now, not the leader of my party."
Right, yeah.
You know, what she should have said is, I preferred Clinton in the primary, but in the end, you know, I much more preferred Obama than Mitt Romney because, you know, it's the
Romney-McConnell
proposal for how this country goes. Easy. Done.
Yeah,
you know?
Easy. I agree. That's the answer.
She didn't do that. She was asked multiple times about that.
And it's not a hard question, you know?
I've always gotten the sense that she's what?
It's not a hard question either. That's the kind of thing. She clearly spent time preparing an answer. Like, she had an answer she thought of before that she gave, and it wasn't a good one. And it sounded so bad.
You think this is prepared? I thought this was knee-jerk and
unprepared. I thought it was prepared. I thought she talks about the sanctity of the ballot box. She says Obama's not on the ballot. She said, what else does she say? I'm a Clinton Democrat. Everything sounds like something she's thought about and like something she's scripted. I mean, she doesn't go off script in this race. Like, she hasn't been saying things off the cuff. She hasn't been mouthing off and, you know, fairly gaffe-free. What it sounded like to me was her trying to get around having to answer that question. And she's dodged reporters before asking her that question too. So, and understandably so, because this is not a comfortable
video to
watch.
So is that, you know, if you ask, I don't know, a candidate, you know, during the dearth of the Bush years, did you support George Bush? Is it the same answer?
I think you say, I voted for George W. Bush, but I disagree with him on XYZ.
Right.
Because
you just go with that.
Because otherwise you sound very cowardly and you sound weird. And Michelle Nunn's doing the same thing. She won't say if she voted for Obama. Come on. What is that?
I want to call foul on this. I got to disagree.
Really?
At this point. Yeah. Here's why. Because yesterday the Oppo research group America Rising released a video of a tracker asking Nunn this question.
Mm-hmm.
Nunn is conspicuously careful and does not and is off the cuff. But she was asked by a tracker. She wasn't asked by an editorial board.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't respond, which is different than Grimes' answer of, like, opening her mouth and saying something. So I think, and the situation, she was approached on the street. This was a sit-down interview that Grimes agreed to on this point. I would love to hear what Nunn has to say on that point.
Mm-hmm.
Believe me. But I don't think it's analogous.
I think it's that's a fair point. I think it's reasonable for reporters to call all Democratic candidates and ask if they voted for Obama. That seems like a no-brainer.
Now,
we should do that tomorrow.
Why not? America Rising, well, I guess that's what we're doing.
Why don't politics reporters do that? Like, that's,
we should all be like, okay,
that.
I saw this clip.
That's a 30-second story. That is extremely easy. Right. So, yeah, I'm going to do that. Journalism.
Good job, us. So,
truth to power.
I just don't. I don't know why there it is. The last few minutes, I wanted to rant about basically. I know this is going to sound really weird, but like we're reaching the holiday season, and the things I'm sick of, besides pumpkin spice everything, which I think is really overrated and terrible, is like what you're supposed to do in DC. For this election cycle and after, are you supposed to go somewhere? Are we supposed to stay here and prepare and, you know, not make reservations because it looks like there's going to be at least one runoff in Louisiana or other ones? I guess it sort of falls into like, are we all living in DC? Or are we just squatting here while we work here?
My question is like, the midterm elections are messing up Christmas travel plans because...
Are they? Yeah. Are you? What are you doing?
I'm not sure. I'm changing jobs. I haven't really talked about it with my editors. So it looks like there's a possibility. It looks like it's almost guaranteed runoff in Louisiana. And then strong possibility of a runoff in Georgia because there's a Libertarian candidate. The Georgia Senate race, fun fact, the Georgia Senate race went to a runoff in 2008. So it would not be unprecedented or even historic for it to go to a runoff this time. Woohoo! And that runoff wouldn't happen until January. So, I mean, there's going to be campaign news. I don't think, even if Republicans do well on election night, I don't see that. I see them needing one or two seats to have a majority. So there's a good chance we won't know who the majority leader is until December, even January.
Fantastic. Do you think that's actually going to help, like, the country's view of politics? Because I don't. I think they're going to hate it even more. I mean, during the Christmas season, they're going to be inundated instead of, you know, Charlie Brown commercials.
During the Christmas season,
like, Bill Cassidy, Mary Landry, evil, you know? Are you looking forward to that?
Gaff.
Yeah. She was at Christmas instead of out campaigning.
Really, guys? You know what I think is going to happen?
Look at this picture of Mary Landry hitting a holiday bong or something. Or, you know, like,
Bill Cassidy made a video ad with a weird facial expression in it. Ha! Look at his weird facial expression. You know, you know what I think is going to happen? I think nobody's going to pay attention to these stories. I think we're going to have a runoff, and we're all going to be, you know, ferociously, can you believe Bill Cassidy's weird facial expression? And nobody's going to read it, and it's not going to be good for business. And
this is the fear of reporters. This is the second fear. One is, like, to be Manti Te'o'd, and the second one is, you know, no, you write something and no one will read it.
A lonely road.
It didn't happen to us, Betsy. You saw, like, this happened. This didn't happen.
Right. It's true. It hasn't even happened yet. So, and, you know, who knows? Maybe something crazy will happen in Louisiana, and everyone will be excited about it, and everyone will click on all the stories, and it'll be so fun. Maybe in Georgia. Who knows? Georgia's an interesting state. Louisiana's an interesting state. At least the campaign reporters traveling to that state. It's better than if Alaska had a runoff, or, like, if Iowa had a runoff. You want to go to Iowa in January? I mean, no offense to Iowa.
I would prefer not to. But that's not my Big Ten state. Big Ten state is Michigan, so I'm from Illinois. So, okay, right before we go, can you tell us anything else about your job? What are you going to do?
I can't.
How often are you going to write any of that stuff?
The idea is I'm going to be filing maybe 8 times a week, so I'm going to be writing more than I'm writing now, which is exciting, and I'm going to be focusing on covering Republicans. So the conservative movement, which is where a lot of my good sourcing is, 2016 stuff, how the libertarian impulse movement, liberty movement, is affecting the Republican Party, how all these moving parts are shifting. You know, the Republican 2016 primary is the most interesting election story in the next couple of years, because everything about Hillary Clinton most of it has been written. So that's what I'll be focusing on.
Writing some of that too.
Yeah, so that's what I'm going to be focusing on. I'll probably be doing a little bit of non-politics writing, like, you know, books, TV, as that arises. Because Slate's very different from Washington Examiner because it's not really written for as much of, like, a politics-centric audience. It's more written to an audience of people who are curious about general things, and that MC politics is a subset of why they go. So it's not going to be as much horse race stuff, probably. It's not going to be as much writing up polls. It can be a little bit less wonky, which I'll miss doing that. But I'm excited. I think it's going to be really fun.
Well, I've always been a fan of your work, Betsy, so I'm excited to see you and, you know, Purple Headline. I am also excited because we always, I mean, one of the things at Woodruff and Strauss we struggle on is not to flood guests who are from TPM and the Washington Examiner.
Yeah.
So, and we have a good bench for those guys, but otherwise we can't have them on here too much. But I will look forward to fighting to try and get as many Slate reporters on in our episodes. Nice. Anyway, Betsy, as always, it's been great. I will talk to you next time.
You too. All right. See you soon.